People are really taking in the death reflections. Yeah, right. You don't have a choice. Something Woody Allen said. The good thing about death, it's one of the few things you can just do just as easily lying down. What is the funeral protocols for monks? Same as for non-monastics? And question in the West? Question, and that it really depends on the situation. certainly for it. Like for very senior monks, then the funeral protocols get sort of over the top. I mean, in the sense of it gets a bit more complicated. There's more more ceremony. It's just more people. It's like for Ajahn Chah's funeral, then, we had, on the day, then we had, I don't know, close to 400,000 people. So, that's a lot of planning. You know, toilets and showers for 400,000 people. And we had people living in the monastery for about 10 days over the whole period. And, so there was, in the monastery, there was about 5,000 or 6,000 monks, about 1,000 nuns, about 500 to 1,000 laymen, about, well, I don't know, 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 lay women, all living in the monastery under little tents, umbrellas, and mosquito nets, and practicing. Everybody practicing together. It's very beautiful. And there's about 40 kitchens in the monastery set up by volunteers to feed everybody. So a very beautiful atmosphere, and people coming through all the time. Say in the circumstance that Jan Janiko mentioned this afternoon, then the protocols were pretty close to non-monastics, except that, I say, with non-monastics, it's a lot of family is there, and in this case, as monastics, and particularly being a foreign. And then many of the lay people came out, and in many of the different monasteries, just to give that kind of support. So it tends to be tends for both non-monastics as well as monastics. It's quite, it's very public. Nothing's very hidden in Thailand. In fact, not at all. So that you'll see, at all sorts of different funerals, the body will be open, and then just before the lighting of the funeral pyre, then people will come up and pour water over the just a little bit of water, and it's like a both a dedication of merit and a blessing, as well as a viewing of the body, and you'll see that children going up on their own to do it, or children going up with their parents to do it. It's actually To me, it's very kind of wholesome. In the West, I haven't really had any experience yet. Just the funeral protocols are I was thinking, like, when the abbot of City of 10,000 Buddhas passed away, then they had a cremation ceremony at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, and they had to go all the way up to the governor of California in order to get permission to do that. And then they had to purchase a mobile cremation unit to do it. So it was incredibly complicated and expensive. So so in the West, it's very prescribed, and one has to go through the proper authorities. And the last part of it is, I've been thinking of something simple and appropriate to do with my body. Cremation and scattering ashes sounds okay to me. However, the green funeral, quote unquote, would be the cleanest solution for the environment. In this case, the wrap corpse would be buried in a forest. I've actually only seen that one time, and not in America. So I don't know what, and the laws are very strict in the West, so I don't know what the what one can actually do. I haven't had that much experience. But I did see it in England. It's actually the person who offered the Chithurst Forest, which became Chithurst Forest Monastery, and when his mother passed away, then they had it arranged, and they brought her out to be buried in the forest. That was. I don't know if she was on board or not. He was a quirky character. it was a very lovely, ceremony, a way to do it. And I think also very moving for him, because he would, donated this very large tract of forest, 130 acres of forest in West Sussex. West Sussex is, I don't know, kind of the, how do I call it, stockbroker belt. It's a prime real estate. And for him to be able to have his mother there, that was very touching for him. Over the last couple of years, I've been noticing that my memory retention isn't quite what it used to be. I'm still quite young, so this observation disturbs me a little, and I wonder if it's just going to get worse. In your experience, has meditation practice helped sharpen the memory? I'm not sure. I can't remember, but it makes me feel better about it. yeah. And I think, just in general, that as we tend to develop the mindfulness, because that's actually the function of mindfulness, is a function of memory, and although we might, we have very selective memories. And as we develop our mindfulness, then I think our memory selects things that that we tend to file away in memory, and it stays there. And some things we just disregard. So some, I think, as we do get older, it changes what we think is important to pay attention to, and to remember. I've been reflecting on no self, and it hasn't quite been resonating. Instead, it feels like a daunting abstraction. Can you suggest a simple way to approach this? I think just the simplest way, because it's not no self, it's sort of not self, and it seems like a small distinction, but it's actually a very large distinction in the sense that isn't as if it's no self of, well, there is nothing there. It's no, it is, there's a negation of self. It's just that what we tend to take as self and identify in that process of this is who I am, this is me, this is mine, all of those things are of a very changing, transitory nature, so that they can't, if something is constantly changing and shifting and becoming other, then it's really not worthy of investing that sense of identification with it as self, so we can recognize, oh, this is not self. And then we can recognize, then we can pay attention to it in more of, oh, these are aspects of nature, so that the body. You know, of course, it's not anybody else's, but it's to say this is who I truly am doesn't really get it, because if it were true, if it were, say, like a self, in the sense of something solid and real and stable, then we should be able to say to it, you should be able to just tell your knees and say, you don't need to hurt anymore. you can't do that. So that you can't say, you can just sort of, if we're retreating, okay, this is enough coughing for this. that's it, I'm done with the coughing bit, but you can't. It's just sort of these things follow their patterns of causes and conditions according to nature, and we have to view it in that sense, not as a self or as me, but as a conglomerate of things that are functioning within the sphere of nature. I saw one of your new publications, Don't Hold Back. Why did you choose this title? The chapter about chanting answered many questions I had. Chanting feels to me like energizing and calming and uplifting. Great. I didn't actually choose the title. That was Rana. There she is in the back. So that. It's the last line of one of the talks, and Rana thought, oh, okay, that'd be a good title. So she ran it past me. I said, sure, yeah, that sounds good. That was funeral and memorial services are not only important for those left behind, but maybe as important for the new traveler in afterlife. Could you say some more about supporting a dead person? What kind of support and how long? Years. There's a question. And how long? Question. Years. Question. Does human support matter, or does karma of each individual take care of it? I think that the reality is, the boundaries between life and death, and between us as individuals, particularly when there's strong bonds of care and love, then there's a tuning in that happens, and that kind of the boundary between life and death is a bit blurry, and so of course, if one is a committed nihilist, then it doesn't really mean much. But certainly in a traditional Buddhist culture, and my own kind of experiences, the function of ritual, funerals, memorials, other types of ritual, are to bring people together, and then particularly in terms of a memorial service or funerals, it isn't just for the people who are left behind, but also for that person. It's also, say, like why in Thailand, when somebody normally cremation is the general standard after somebody passes away, but if somebody has had a violent death, a sudden death, or suicide, then they'll keep the body for usually at least a year and maybe longer, so that there's a tangible reminder for that person, because either there's been a confusion at the time of death, or some kind of emotional trauma at the time of death. So one wants to be able to allow them to recognize that they've actually died, because that's it's important for a person who's passed away to be able to integrate that, and then to be able to go on, and so that they'll keep the bodies usually for a year, two, three, and then do a cremation later. But all that time, they'll be doing dedications of merit, dedications of blessings, making offerings in the name of that person. I remember one monk I know who was his name was Lumpa Panyananda. He was a very well-known teacher, speaker of Dhamma, and very much a person who spoke out against empty ritual and superstition in Thai Buddhist culture. He often stepped on people's toes a bit, he felt that was really important, because there can be too much superstition. I remember sitting and talking with him one day, and he's saying, you know, sometimes people think these ceremonies of dedication of merit and blessings after death are just superstitious. He said, but I've talked to too many people who've had very strong experiences, and he said, it was just last year, it was somebody that a relative, he comes from the south of Thailand, and of course many of the southerners are fishermen, and this person's boat was sunk at sea, and his other crew members drowned, and he was the only person who survived. And so all his family thought that he had died, but he was actually floating around out on the sea, and had some. He was able to survive for a week or 10 days or something before he was found and rescued. But because the news had come, then his family had assumed that he was dead. And he said that all during that time, of course, he had tremendous thirst and hunger. He said, but that would always be allayed. It would always subside when the family, coinciding with when the family was doing ceremonies and dedicating merit. And is that mean it was directly there, or was it a knowledge that he knew that was happening? I don't know. But that's something that he experienced. So it does have a beneficial effect. And I think that over one can shortly after somebody has passed away, then it's typical to do ceremonies up to a week, and then after 2 weeks, and then 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 50 days, 100 days. After a year, and then usually after that on an annual basis, so that's a typical a typical pattern. Okay, Ajahn, I found your explanation of the theme of constancy, quote unquote, in practice as a constancy in keeping a bright and awake mind more helpful and doable than a constancy in keeping to one meditation object, as is sometimes taught. Could you please say more? Well, I think that's, of course, that's what I found helpful and doable also. So that it's held a bit broader. Because sometimes just trying to keep the mind on, say, a meditation object tires the mind out, and so that finding ways that we can brighten the mind or keep the mind alert and interested, both in the meditation object, but then also in, okay, how do I experience the meditation object? How do I experience the mind that's observing the meditation? So, because that whole sphere has to be understood, it isn't as if something magical is going to happen if we just keep grinding away at the meditation object. There's a broader sphere of understanding and knowledge that we have to cultivate in order to, because when we think of what is it that is the most central part of the Buddha's teachings, and over and over again, the basis of insight are around the themes of anicca, dukkha, anatta, or impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. So it's more like looking at patterns than looking at specifics. So looking at the patterns, and that's how, you know, when we think of when something accords with Dhamma, then it's according with patterns in nature that we can recognize and understand. And that allows us to put down different types of things that agitate the mind, whether it's desire or worry or fear or whatever. But it helps to allay those tendencies. So it's understanding those patterns. And that's where we can really settle. Would you please comment on the highest blessings, where it reads, avoiding those of foolish ways, and then further on where it says, and cherishing family. You see where this is going. What if family members engage in foolish ways, like addiction to alcohol, and one cannot always avoid them? Can one cherish one with foolish ways? One can have compassion for them. One can recognize. I mean, some people you can choose to spend time with, and family to a certain degree, where we're thrown in the mix with them, and but still, I mean, there's a there are ways of being with family, even if they do engage in unskillful conduct or have foolish ways, and it's not being in contention with them, not getting in conflict. It doesn't mean that one is giving approval, but it's also being able to maintain some kind of skillful contact, because it's like Ajahn Nyaniko saying in his talk of how much we want to be understood, and especially if we hold certain values, and then our family doesn't have the same values, and then we feel either uncomfortable or offended by that. It's actually one of the things that whenever monks come to me and make a request to go and visit family, I always sort of sit down and give them a talk on, you're not going there to teach them. You're not going there to get in conflict with them. And just go there and be present. And it's a, there's always that that kind of idealism that one would like to have one's family follow one's own values, but mostly it doesn't work out like that. So then You know, we do have to maintain our own boundaries without getting in conflict. Yeah, that's important. That's an important skill to be able to do that. Okay, it seems that every year I expect less from myself at a retreat. It seems also, by and large, that every year a retreat becomes easier, happier, and more peaceful. Would you say this is because, one, I'm getting wiser, two, I'm abandoning all intentions, three, I'm running out of hormones? Probably all of the above. Yeah, I think... this part of the sense of the fact that one keeps coming back every year is also there's a certain wisdom there, and then seeing the benefit, I think we. You know, just by putting ourselves in these situations, we learn, and then not having the same kind of expectations and the kind of the doing mind, and it really drives ourselves nuts, and oftentimes drives the people around us nuts. So that learning how to be holding things more spaciously and being more easeful, but still doing it. Where do the Brahma Viharas fit into the Four Noble Truths? This would need a bit of an extrapolation in the sense that it doesn't fit immediately, but it's easy to fit it into the path of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. So that many of the teachings aren't explicit, but the that development of Brahma Viharas, divine abidings of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. These are part of the mental states and attitudes that one develops in say that quality of sammasankappa, of right intention, so that one's cultivating that, and then as we implement those qualities of kindness, compassion, gladness, equanimity into our actions, those result in right speech, right action, and of course they then inform the qualities of right effort, right mindfulness, and of course concentration that's based on these Brahma Viharas is part of the different meditation practices. So it fits into in terms of the Four Noble Truths, the fourth truth of the path leading to cessation of suffering. Thank you for the most profound expository discourse on the Anapanasati. This is the only place which explains the active nature of observing the breath and the meaning of breath body. These made good sense. Question one: was this talk recorded? Yes, it was. If so, will it be available online? Usually it's up sometime after the, whenever it usually gets cleaned up and then gets put online on our website. Do you have it recorded elsewhere? There's actually, like today, I gave a kind of an overview of Anapanasati. And is it actually on our website? The talks that I did years ago. Okay. At the monastery, certainly. I'm not sure if it's online. But at the monastery, there's a... what year was that that I did that? 2005. 2005. We started the winter retreat, and so I started... Okay, well, we're starting winter retreat. I give some instruction on mindfulness of breathing. And so I started, and... I think did about 17 talks on mindfulness of breathing. So that's available. I went through the whole discourse. I didn't have a plan to start like that, but which is usually the case. But then it sort of, okay, well, this seems like a good thing to do, just follow up on it. So that it's easy just to write to the monastery. One check and see if it is online on our website, and if not, then to we do have CDs of it there if anybody wants. Do you have an essay with your explanation? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think it's been transcribed. If not, I notice a few yogis were taking notes. Perhaps they can send them to you for corrections and share with Sangha. But I think there's enough material there anyway. And then question two, how do you practice it? I imagine in terms of me, how do I practice it? Do you need to memorize it and note all the aspects? And then in brackets, take them off and get a certificate. So, but that there's a, you know, that and that's of course where it gets you know, kind of interesting in the sense of familiarizing oneself with those all these different aspects of mindfulness of breathing. Learning them, memorizing them, getting a feel for them, and then. Experimenting and seeing what actually is useful to one, and sometimes it could be that you do okay. Start with one and go down the list at 1 to 16, and just to keep yourself on track. At other times, you'll find a place where you start to sit and the mind just wants to go to a particular aspect of mindfulness of breathing. At other times one finds that particular aspects, you just want to keep going to it over and over again to really let it sink in and settle as a both as a reflection as well as a way of settling the mind, because these are particularly the Anapanasati is a versatile way of practicing, so that it can be both a way of settling and stilling the mind as well as a reflective and investigative meditation. So one can be using it in whatever way is useful for one. Is the pursuit of peace, cessation, stillness, any different from any other pursuit or desire? is it not unattainable in a constant form? Is it like a sensual desire? One can achieve it often with practice, but never as a constant state of being. Thank you for addressing this. It is and it isn't in a way that, say, the peace as a condition or cessation as a condition or stillness as a condition is something that you can manipulate circumstances, or you can direct your mind in certain ways so that you become skilled at getting that. But that also is another condition. And the purpose of Buddhism isn't to just create a peaceful state of mind or to be able to replicate cessation and make a stillness appear. One utilizes them, relies on them because they're a flavor, they're a taste. But what one is looking at is understanding the nature of conditions. Understand being at peace within the limitation of conditions. When one understands something so clearly that one isn't fooled by anything, one is able to have a stability and unshakability within those, within any conditions. But it doesn't mean that you've got this bit of stillness that you can hang on to, because that's any condition is going to change. But your relationship to the conditions is very different, so that there's not an attempt to try to manipulate conditions to be as one prefers or wants, or but it's understanding clearly within the conditions, and not feeding the tendencies that allow us to become agitated or drawn into things that will cloud that. Okay, Ajahn, can you please speak about dealing with physical pain during a sit? I know, in brackets, I know you often speak about knee pain. My practice currently involves a 30 to 60 minute sit 4 to 5 times a week. The extra sitting here has triggered back pain and headaches. During some of my sits, I'll send my breath energy to these areas and it helps, but the problem eventually returns. My patient endurance is turning into impatient frustration. Mara may be laughing, but I'm not giving in. Okay. I think one of the things is to recognize that, we're doing more sitting than you're used to, so that the body isn't used to it. And so one needs to temper the sitting either in a chair or extra cushions, or we've got all these wonderful pews at the back there, and just to alternate so that you're giving yourself that physical support, and then as well, attending to using the breath energy, consciously relaxing, and finding ways to ease the body through softening and relaxing, because a lot of the pain that we experience is oftentimes from sitting a bit out of kilter in our posture, and then of course it starts to get a bit uncomfortable, and then we have to put more effort in to hold it, and that just makes it worse. So that is really learning how to learn about the body and soften, relax. A lot of it is in being able to relax into the posture, and then, but that's within certain boundaries, because again, if one's is not used to sitting longer periods, then and then this is many times more than one is used to. The body is going to complain. It's going to rebel, and that's how your body is telling you, I've had enough with this sitting. Get me somewhere else. And also doing walking meditation. Walking meditation is so easily overlooked, its benefits so that sometimes if doing an extra period of walking meditation just walking slowly and just really being able to relax into the rhythm and the sensation of the walking. Walking meditation, it ends up sort of kind of the poor cousin of sitting meditation, but especially in the forest tradition, many of the great teachers, Ajahn Chah certainly, it always praised the walking meditation and try to encourage all of us to be doing a lot of walking meditation. I tend to be doing a fair bit of sitting because I'm enjoying it. And so I get the opportunity, because if I'm at the monastery, there's always, if you're an abbot, then there's always somebody knocking on your door, or something that needs to be done. So that being here, I get to sit more and get more still. So I enjoy that. And but it's also important in terms of physical pain to recognize when there is pain, and then not to add one's aversion to it, or one's or fear and worry, or just that, because we tend to we want to push it away, we want to annihilate it, we don't, and pain is not in general, it's usually not at levels that are life-threatening, so that learning to be comfortable with a little bit of discomfort. It isn't always sort of pain-free, but it can be comfortable, and because the mind isn't reacting, isn't agitated. And then it's not adding an extra layer of mental pain to a physical pain. Seems like the reflection on the 32 parts of the body is missing several parts. It's for nose, muscles, sex organs, etc. Is it meant to be comprehensive? Or is it just the ugly bits? uh. It's not meant to be comprehensive. I think even the Buddha knew there are other parts. I think the Buddha, particularly in the Buddha's time, part of it was having a fairly representative bits of the body. One in terms of the like with the elements, the material elements, the earth elements, so hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, these are all, and internal organs are all solid, solid bits. And then sweat, blood, tears, these are all the liquid bits, sort of the fluid element. And so that's seeing it in terms of, one can then also investigate it in terms of elements. Also that with the it is interesting in terms of the first five hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. In terms of a human body, that's actually all you see. It gets differentiated into other things. But when you actually see somebody, that's it. Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. And as we spend inordinate amounts of time and resources in reshaping, configuring, looking at them, okay, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. That's really simple. So there's a lot of these contemplations are for helping the mind to be simplified. And also even in the sense that it's interesting in the Satipatthana Sutta, when the Buddha, that's one of the meditations that the Buddha explains. And the word that's used is asubha, so unattractive. It's asubha gamata, unattractive. And the way that the image that the Buddha gives and the simile is of a sack or a bag open at one end that has all these different grains in it, so that there's hill rice and paddy rice and there's green beans, there's red beans, there's and so there's all these different types of grains. And that sort of, and it's more so that the image is more pointing to an evenness, so that rather than getting excited about an attractive red bean, there's an evenness there. So in the same way, just contemplating the body, so that there's one looks and sees, oh yeah, there's hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. There's a very neutral. It's not that exciting, really. So it gives a coolness that we can experience. Please explain which comes first, birth or becoming. For example, with anger or any feeling or character. In the teachings, the Buddha places becoming first, so that becoming the word is bhava, which is sort of like being or becoming. So it's like a movement within the mind, and then a fully formed birth takes place after that. So whether that's on a human level or on a mental level, there's the movement towards something, a movement towards desire, a movement towards ill will, and then anger is born out of that, or a desire is born out of that. It takes shape and focuses itself, so that the movement towards something is the being, becoming energy, so that's a movement within the mind, that gravitating towards something, and then it takes shape and forms itself after, which is birth. Okay, so managed to get through the questions. Have a bit of a break. Come back for evening chanting.